KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It was the United States which, in the midst of a process to forge a diplomatic outcome, betrayed diplomacy.
After the U.S. bombings on Iran, where do we go from here? For Sunday, June 22nd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. All this hour, we break down what's at stake now that the U.S. has entered the fight between Iran and Israel. We'll hear from everyday Iranians and an acclaimed Iranian-American novelist.
Our interiority is as complex and miraculous as yours.
And we get a big picture view on what the attacks mean for Iran and its foreign allies. And a bit of fun for today, Jaws turns 50.
I'd put Jaws in the same category in my head as something like The Godfather or Maltese Falcon, Citizen Kane. It's like, this movie is going to teach you how to make a movie.
Some film history to chew on. First news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Pentagon says U.S. stealth bombers returned without taking fire in yesterday's strikes on Iranian nuclear sites. NPR's Cole Lawrence has more.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said the surprise attack included the first use of American massive ordnance penetrating bombs designed to hit fortified bunkers deep underground like the Iranian nuclear site in Fordo. He said they appear to have hit their targets. Hegseth stressed that U.S. goals are limited.
The president authorized a precision operation to neutralize the threats to our national interests posed by the Iranian nuclear program and the collective self-defense of our troops and our ally Israel.
General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said it's too early to see just how effective the strikes were. U.S. troops on bases in the region where Iran has struck in the past are on high alert for possible retaliation. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Russia is condemning the Trump administration's attacks on Iran as it pushes for a diplomatic solution. NPR's Charles Maines has more.
Russia's foreign ministry issued a statement that called the U.S. attacks a flagrant violation of international law. The Kremlin was more muted, saying only President Vladimir Putin had no immediate plans to contact President Trump. Putin has repeatedly offered Moscow as an intermediary on the Iran issue, saying a deal could be reached that secured both Iran's right to a civilian nuclear energy program and Israel's security. Putin has also fended off criticism at home that he has not done enough to support his allies in Tehran, despite a strategic partnership agreement and Iran providing Russia with drones for the war in Ukraine. Iran's foreign minister is expected in Moscow for talks Monday. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
And international monitors say so far they haven't seen any widespread environmental contamination from the strikes. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports any radiological or chemical hazards seem to be confined to the attacked sites.
The International Atomic Energy Agency says it's been informed by the Iranian regulatory authorities that there has been no increase in off-site radiation levels. And the agency says at this time it's not expecting any health consequences for people or the environment outside the targeted sites. Neighboring countries have been watching the situation closely. The government of Kuwait put out a statement which said that no abnormal radiation levels have been detected by any of the member states of the Gulf Cooperation Council and that monitoring would continue. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
A judge in Tennessee denied the federal government's motion to detain Kilmer Abrego Garcia. He's the Maryland man the Trump administration mistakenly deported to El Salvador. Judge Barbara Holmes set a hearing for Wednesday to review conditions of his release, though the government has already filed a motion to appeal the judge's release order. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The National Weather Service posted extreme heat warnings today from the northern plains to the Midwest to the East Coast. This is a heat dome with triple-digit temperatures is forecast for this week, and it's expected to affect more than 66 million people. Human-caused climate change is said to have devastating impacts on global crops. That's according to a new study in Nature. As NPR's Julia Simon reports, the effects will be pronounced in the U.S.
The scientists analyzed the effect of global heating on six key crops: wheat, soybeans, rice, maize, cassava, and sorghum. They looked at 54 countries, including the U.S., and they found those crop yields will decline 11.2% by the end of the century compared to a world without warming. If humans keep burning large amounts of fossil fuels, wheat production could fall 40% in the U.S. by the end of the century, according to the study. Soybean production could fall by 50%. Scientists say we do already have scalable solutions to slow global warming. A key solution is to reduce the use of planet-heating fossil fuels by switching to wind and solar energy combined with large battery storage systems. Julia Simon, NPR News.
At the weekend box office, How to Train Your Dragon took the top spot once again with an estimated $37 million in ticket sales. The Universal Pictures live-action remake has made $358 million worldwide so far. A sequel is already in the works for the $150 million production. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong, in for Scott Detrow. The United States has entered the fight between Israel and Iran. All this hour, we'll take stock of the U.S. strikes against three nuclear facilities in Iran and consider what they mean for people in the region and around the world. And we begin by discussing the military operation itself. Dubbed Operation Midnight Hammer, the American military strikes on nuclear facilities in Iran were complex, with the details closely held. For more, we turn to NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Hey, Tom.
Hey there.
Tom, you were at the Pentagon today for a briefing. What stood out to you this morning?
Well, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Dan Kane briefed reporters this morning. They said three nuclear sites in Iran were hit. There were more than 125 aircraft, including B-2 bombers, dropping multiple so-called bunker busters, the first time they were used in combat. Also, a submarine was used firing several dozen Tomahawk missiles. There was some deception as well. Some of the B-2s flew west from a base in Missouri over the Pacific. That was a decoy mission. The B-2s attacking Iran flew east over the Atlantic, refueling in midair and then being joined by fighter aircraft once they were over land. Officials said Iran was caught completely off guard. No shots were fired at the U.S. aircraft. Iranian planes did not even take to the skies, and no Iranian missiles were fired. Secretary Hegseth said this is about degrading Iranian nuclear programs. These were limited strikes, and this is not about regime change. He said it's time for Iran to seek peace and come to the table. A big question is what happens if Iran does not come to the table or drags out talks with European officials? Clearly, Israel will continue attacks as we saw today, but will the U.S. mount additional strikes if Iran does not seek peace? We just don't know. And a big question is how will Iran respond now?
Yeah.
And you're right, the mission is called Operation Midnight Hammer, and details were very closely held. Congressional leaders were only notified after the attacks were over, attacks that took about 25 minutes. And while U.S. bases in the Middle East were placed on higher alert, those bases were not given a heads up about the attack.
Now, Tom, the White House is calling this a successful attack. What does that mean when it comes to Iran's nuclear program? Like, how effective were these strikes?
Well, they're still doing the damage assessment. It's ongoing. It'll take a few days to get a better sense of what happened based on a wide variety of intelligence. President Trump, of course, said the sites were obliterated, but it's uncertain at this point if that's true. Of course, analysts have long said that even with such strikes, it can't completely end an Iranian nuclear ambitions. So again, what is the way ahead? The U.S. is clearly at war with Iran now. In the past, the U.S. has hit oil platforms, but never Iran proper.
Yeah, let's talk about the regional implications, especially for U.S. bases and the people serving there.
No, it's a huge concern. And Hegseth said if Iran hits any of these bases, the U.S. will reply with even greater attacks. There are some 40,000 U.S. troops in the region in Bahrain, Qatar, Iraq and Syria among them. 5 years ago, during Trump's first administration, when the U.S. assassinated Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, Iran responded with a ballistic missile attack, injuring a number of service members. So a concern is, could something like that happen again by Iran or by Iranian militias? We'll just have to wait and see.
All right. Yeah, we'll wait and see. That's NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Tom, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Now, in response to the U.S. attacks, Iran has been gathering support from its allies, including Russia and China. Possible Iranian retaliation could include closing a key oil shipping lane, and it kept up attacks today on Israel. NPR's Jane Arraf joins us from Amman, Jordan. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Andrew.
The U.S. strikes were a huge blow against Iran. How has Iranian leadership responded?
Well, we don't know where Iran's supreme leader is, and given the U.S. and Israeli threats to assassinate him, that's perhaps understandable. But Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, was in Istanbul, where he was talking to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. He said the path to diplomacy should always be open, but he also said Iran wouldn't negotiate under attack. And here, he says the U.S. essentially blew up negotiations.
The world must not forget that it was the United States which, in the midst of a process to forge a diplomatic outcome, betrayed diplomacy.
He says the U.S. did that by backing Israeli attacks on Iran while Iran was holding indirect talks through Oman with the United States.
Now, Iran has been weakened over the past 2 years, but it is not without friends. What are those friends doing?
Yeah, well, Araghchi, the foreign minister, was heading to Moscow. Huh. He's scheduled to meet with President Vladimir Putin tomorrow. Here he is.
Russia is a friend of Iran, and we enjoy a strategic partnership, and we always consult with each other and coordinate our positions.
Now, one of the Western concerns, of course, is that this U.S. attack could actually further unite two big U.S. enemies, Iran and Russia.
Has Iran responded to yesterday's attack militarily?
It says it launched 27 missiles at Israel after the U.S. attack, and it said the targets included Ben-Gurion Airport and research facilities. The airport didn't appear to have been hit, as aviation authorities said it would open tomorrow for evacuation flights. It's often difficult to know exactly what has been hit in Israel, though, because the government imposes a gag order on media that prevents it from identifying military and security sites. But Iran, Andrew, isn't just firing missiles. They've raised the possibility of closing the Strait of Hormuz. That's that really narrow shipping lane that 20% of the world's oil and gas goes through. And that, of course, would raise global prices for oil. Iran's foreign minister said that was among the measures they're considering taking.
What about ordinary Iranians? What measures are they taking to protect themselves?
We spoke to a woman in her 20s named Roxana in Tehran. She's a shop manager. We're not using her full name because she could face security problems for talking to foreign media. As you might imagine, Iranians are not getting a lot of information, and they're scared and confused.
نمیشه دقیقاً اعتماد کرد که چجوریه و این ابهام خیلی آدم‌ها رو مضطرب می‌کنه.
Here she says, we can't know what's happening, and this uncertainty causes a lot of anxiety. She says she's resorted to asking internet AI, artificial intelligence, what's happening. She says everything is really scary for everyone.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's NPR's Jane Arraf, who's joining us from Amman, Jordan. Jane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we just heard, many Iranians are confused and experiencing mixed emotions right now. Some hope the U.S. strikes will bring an end to the hardline regime. Others worry it'll start a broader war. An NPR translator talked with several people in Iran about the strike, and they also all asked that we not use their full names out of fear of retribution by the Iranian regime for speaking to foreign media. NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam brings us their stories.
It was around 2:30 in the morning when Zahra was woken from her sleep in the city of Qom, near Fordo, the uranium enrichment site buried deep inside a mountain.
There was a series of explosions together with fighter jets that were tearing the sky apart.
Zahra, a 44-year-old manager at a construction site, said she went on the internet and saw Trump announce the strikes on Fordo. Zahra said it all happened very fast.
The jets came smoothly and easily and hit their targets and went away. We did not see or hear any air defense or any other kind of defense.
The Trump administration says it inflicted serious damage on Fordo, as well as Isfahan and Natanz nuclear sites. But Sabah, a 42-year-old university professor, says there's some confusion in Iran about the extent of the damage.
Some Arab channels say the damage has been minor. The U.S. claims it destroyed Fordo completely. Iran, as usual, downplays it and says nothing was kept there.
Sahar, a 37-year-old unemployed accountant, was overjoyed about the U.S. strikes because it could mean the end to decades of Iran's hardline regime.
Even if I die, I will be so happy about this, because so many innocent people have been dying because of this regime all these decades. I even thank the U.S. and Israel for these attacks.
Zahra said she wished the Iranian regime wouldn't have played games when Trump offered to find a diplomatic solution and reach a nuclear deal with Iran. She says the U.S. strikes provoked bitter emotions for her.
Thinking about the money that could have been spent giving us and our children a normal life and future that crumbled in seconds because of the stubbornness of the leaders who did not negotiate in time.
19-year-old Sarah, a translator from Mashhad in northeast Iran, says the U.S. strikes have divided many people in the country.
For a revolution and a regime change, a lot of them are monarchists.
Others hope the U.S. strikes mark an end to years of negotiations, sanctions, and conflicts. 41-year-old Ferzone teaches literature at a Tehran university. She says many Iranians are exhausted and want the nuclear issue to be resolved.
I think we have been in a war for many years, and this nuclear war had to have an endpoint. I think this might be the endpoint of this war.
That depends in large part whether Iran chooses to retaliate, risking a broader war that could embroil the whole region. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Listening to NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. In an emergency meeting at the UN Security Council today on President Trump's decision to bomb three nuclear sites in Iran, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an immediate ceasefire and a serious return to sustained negotiations. The U.S. used B-2 stealth bombers and at least one submarine to bomb the sites. The National Weather Service posted extreme heat warnings today from the northern plains to the Midwest to the East Coast. This is a heat dome with triple-digit temperatures is expected to hit today and for the next several days, affecting more than 66 million people. And at the weekend box office, How to Train Your Dragon took the top spot once again with an estimated $37 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. The U.S. bombed three nuclear sites in Iran overnight. Israel said it was a joint operation with the U.S. and Israeli militaries, but the U.S. did the bombing. Iran retaliated by firing missiles at Tel Aviv this morning, setting off sirens. Those were the sounds recorded by NPR's Hadil Al-Shalji from outside her home in Tel Aviv. Israeli medics say there were no fatalities and 23 people were injured across the country, including in a neighborhood in northern Tel Aviv where Hadil brings this report.
In the affluent North Tel Aviv neighborhood of Ramat Aviv, Eretz Zvi observes the buzz of rescue workers and soldiers near the site of this morning's Iranian strike. The windows from his apartment building have been blown out. Metal rods poke out of the walls. Tzvi pulls out his phone to show pictures from his damaged home.
This is from the kitchen. See, there's nothing left.
47-year-old Tzvi says he's grateful that his family is safe.
This is only things, okay? You know, furniture, this is something that we can buy and build. We are fine.
Tzvi says his damaged home is a small price to pay for Israel's security against Iran.
Because we have a huge threat from there. We believe it will be over soon, and Israel will win, as always.
Kohava Lishman was in her shelter, known in Hebrew as a mamad, when the Iranian missile struck near her home.
And there was a very big, we didn't hear it before like that, the boom inside the mamad. Very, very strong.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he'll fight Iran for as long as it takes to dismantle its nuclear capabilities. Lishman says she doesn't trust him.
Netanyahu put us in a very big mess.
She says she wants compromise and dialogue, not war.
To sit and talk and see what we can do, not to escalate that and not to kill people and there and here and everywhere.
The scene in Ramat Aviv is similar to many around Israel that were struck by Iranian missiles this past week. Residents observing buildings wrecked in a way Israelis have never seen before. They take photos, comfort each other, wonder where this war will take them. At a damaged retirement home nearby, a woman makes an announcement. Residents will be taken to a hotel in Jerusalem for their safety. An old woman using a cane is being helped by caregivers. A man carries family portraits and a suitcase on his way out. Close to the home, a group of Tel Aviv municipality youth volunteers have set up tables. They hand out water bottles and try to find those who've lost homes, someplace to stay. Itiel Samet is in charge. We're here to give them a hug so they know they're not alone, Samet says. He says he's glad that the U.S. is supporting Israel in its war with Iran. It gives a sense of security and partnership, knowing that we're working together. It's very uplifting, Samet says. Mira Goshen is in a loud purple outfit, pink lipstick and a streak of blue in her white hair. A green parrot clings to her chest. His name is Chica. 80-year-old Goshen lives on the 11th floor of the damaged retirement home. Her apartment was destroyed.
No pictures, no door. All the roof fell down in the kitchen and the bathroom.
And Chica went missing.
And somebody found him, and the cage is completely ruined. And they start asking, somebody lost a bird?
She says Chica was shivering with fear when she found him. Goshen says that in one way, the war with Iran puts Israelis through a tough time. But like many here, she hopes this major strike can help clear the impetus to resolve the older conflict in Gaza.
In the other way, it's good. Maybe all our chatufim will come out now. Yeah, hostages, I forgot the word.
Goshen says her home may be what she needed to sacrifice. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
To Washington now. The Trump administration has been doing a victory lap after its surprise attack on the three Iranian nuclear sites on Saturday. On NBC's Meet the Press this morning, host Kristen Welker asked Vice President Vance if the U.S. is at war. Here's how he answered.
No, Kristen, we're not at war with Iran. We're at war with Iran's nuclear program.
The White House is also facing pushback from a bipartisan group of lawmakers who say that the attack was made without congressional approval. NPR's Stephen Fowler has been following the political reaction and fallout from the strikes and joins us now. Hi, Stephen.
Hey there.
So it's been nearly 24 hours since the attack in Iran was carried out. How does the Trump administration view yesterday's military operation?
I mean, the White House views it as a success. In a press conference Sunday morning, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said that Iran's nuclear ambitions were, quote, obliterated after President Trump okayed the mission.
The order we received from our commander-in-chief was focused, it was powerful, and it was clear. We devastated the Iranian nuclear program.
On various Sunday morning news shows, Vice President Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio made the rounds and gave interviews explaining more details about this operation that was kept close to the vest until after it happened. Here's Rubio on CBS's Face the Nation.
It was not an attack on Iran. It was not an attack on the Iranian people. This wasn't a regime change move. This was designed to degrade and or destroy three nuclear sites related to their nuclear weaponization ambitions.
Vance and Rubio stressed their belief that these strikes were necessary for national security reasons and were limited and targeted in their focus. And after his cabinet members made it clear this was not a strike on Iran's regime, Trump did float this idea on Truth Social Sunday evening. In a press release today, the White House said the interviews were sending a clear message, and that message is, quote, the world is safer today because of President Donald J. Trump's highly successful precision strikes against the Iranian regime's key nuclear facilities, and that what happens next is up to them.
What is the White House saying about the legality of these strikes, right? Because I know some people are pointing to, like, Article 1 of the Constitution and say that, you know, this required congressional approval.
Well, Vance gave a pretty good summary of the administration's stances on an interview with NBC's Meet the Press.
First of all, the president has clear authority to act to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and the worst weapon of mass destruction of them all is nuclear. The idea that this was outside of presidential authority, I think any real serious legal person would tell you that's not true.
But a lot of people disagree there with the vice president.
Yeah, I imagine that includes congressional Democrats, right? What do they have to say about the strike and how the White House went about it without Congress?
Well, for the most part, Democratic lawmakers say not involving Congress beforehand is unconstitutional before even getting to the merits of the strike being the best course of action. Another thing, top Democrats weren't briefed about the mission until after U.S. forces left Iranian airspace, which they object to as well. In his interview on Meet the Press, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly said what many other Democrats have been saying, namely that the decision to strike without Congress's approval also escalated risk for our troops.
Well, I would say when there's a clear and imminent threat to U.S. citizens, to the United States, to the homeland, the commander-in-chief has a right to act. That wasn't the case here. And I think certainly for the 40,000 troops in at least six countries in the Middle East, we have a lot of bases in the Middle East, those troops are now at greater risk.
Democrats are in the minority and have little power in Congress, but there are many. Are there any Republicans who wish Trump did things differently?
Well, not really. There is one notable exception. That's Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey. Massey was on CBS's Face the Nation today talking about a war powers resolution he's co-sponsoring with Democratic Representative Ro Khanna to prevent military action in Iran without Congress's okay.
They should have called us all back. And frankly, we should have debated this war powers resolution that Ro Khanna and I offered instead of staying on vacation and doing fundraisers and saying, oh, well, the president's got this under control. We're going to cede our constitutional authority.
Why aren't there more Republicans who share Massey's concern about going around Congress?
Well, there are a few things that have been at play during President Trump's second term this year. One, there's even more agreement among Republicans with the policies and priorities that President Trump is pursuing, from things like immigration to the economy to, yes, foreign policy. Basically, there's near unanimous support for bombing Iran's nuclear sites. Two, Republicans in Congress have also been content to let President Trump's view of executive power expand more and more, including into congressional appropriations and these war power type actions that the Constitution says belongs with Congress. So there's not really any pushback and hasn't been for many things this year.
That's NPR's Stephen Fowler. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We heard earlier from everyday people in Iran reacting to the U.S. bombing of Iran. Kaveh Akbar is an Iranian-American poet and writer who lives and teaches in Iowa. His debut novel, Martyr, was published last year to critical acclaim. Akbar has been active in protesting for the rights of Palestinians, and now today he's processing a bombing campaign in Iran, the country he was born in. I caught up with him earlier today, and he began by telling me how his family in Iran is doing.
They're not great. I mean, everyone that you know, every Iranian that you know has people in Tehran, people around Iran who are doing poorly. And it's not just the people immediately under the bombs either. For instance, I have an aunt with stage 4 cancer who needs daily chemo that she has no access to right now. She takes care of a daughter who has never lived without her. Never lives separately from her. And so when we hear things like X number of people killed in this strike, Y number of people killed in that strike, those are atrocities. Those are unprecedented, irreplaceable lives, but so too are the lives like my aunts who are living in absolute terror and dread, and my cousin who is watching her mother get sicker and sicker with nothing to be done about it.
You're a poet. You're also the poetry editor at The Nation. Is there a poem or any bit of literature you've been coming back to or thinking about, whether it be today or the past few weeks?
Yeah, I've been turning to the Palestinian-American poet Fadi Chuda a lot. I like very much his poetry writ large, but he has this poem called Mimesis that feels to me like it's just this perfect little diorama, this perfect little scale model of the crisis writ large. I'd love to share it with you.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you so much.
My daughter wouldn't hurt a spider that had nested between her bicycle handles for 2 weeks. She waited until it left of its own accord. If you tear down the web, I said, it will simply know this isn't a place to call home, and you get to go biking. She said, that's how others become refugees, isn't it?
What about that poem speaks to you?
I love that it works its way into your consciousness through a scene that is entirely domestic. It's a conversation between a father and a daughter. I think a lot of us are being shot rhetoric from a fire hose from both sides, from all sides. And it can sometimes feel a little concussive to be on the receiving end of that, even when we agree with the rhetoric. And I think that what is so miraculous about Fadi's poem is how it just enacts that so beautifully. So I think that demonstrating that kind of learning, that kind of humility, is really valuable.
Has this most recent news shifted the way you're going to be writing in the future, or are you thinking about writing about something about this in the future?
I feel like right now my nose is still too pressed up to the mural to see the bigger picture. My immediate concerns are with my family and friends whose lives are in mortal terror. My immediate notions are towards getting actual facts out to as many people as possible before they're plastered over by the rhetoric of empire, to remind people that, again, I mean, these are human beings. These are the way that we love our children is the way that they love their children. You know, there are emergency vets going around Tehran right now, all over the place, to take care of the animals of the bombed. I mean, the way that we love our pets, the way that I love my dogs here in Iowa City, is the way that my family members love their dogs and love their cats. I mean, it is excruciating to be a person who has to continuously remind people that our interiority is as complex and miraculous as yours, right? It is excruciating to continuously be in that position. But, you know, between my delirious rage and the mortal terror of my family members is a wide delta, and I have to leverage that delta into action.
That was author Kaveh Akbar. Kaveh, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Andrew, for having me. I appreciate it.
Listening to NPR News. We just heard from Iranian-American poet Kaveh Akbar about what he's feeling in Iowa about the news of the bombing of nuclear facilities in Iran. We report now from Los Angeles, which has one of the largest Persian populations outside of Iran. Steve Futterman spoke with Iranian-Americans in L.A. today, wrestling with complicated emotions.
This part of West Los Angeles is the hub of L.A.'s Iranian population, estimated to be 600,000 people. Some have named it Little Persia. Others call it Tehrangelis, a combination of Tehran and Los Angeles.
You have bookstores, you have, you know, Persian shops, you have restaurants. I mean, you know, this is where people kind of come together.
On this Sunday, lots of people came together for breakfast at the Pink Orchid Bakery and Cafe, including Arash H. He doesn't want to give his last name because he fears for relatives still in Iran. He was up pretty much all night as the story developed.
We're following the news, absolutely. Friends were texting each other back and forth, thinking, is this real? Is this happening?
All the people we spoke to opposed the current Iranian government, but they had differing views about the U.S. involvement. Reza B. owns a Persian market. He, too, didn't want to give his last name. He is elated.
Very good. I'm very happy. I'm very happy for my country. I'm so sorry for damage, but I'm happy for future.
You think this is going to work?
Yes. I think I'm very optimistic for future.
But just a few stores down the street, a much different view.
I don't have anything in common with the regime. I don't like them. I hate them. But this is not the right way to do that.
Ruzbeh Farahanipour owns a Greek restaurant. Inside, Farsi lessons were being given to young children. He came to the U.S. in the late 90s. He says he was on an execution list when he left Iran. He does not think U.S. involvement will help.
I don't like any war. And second, in general, I don't like the civilian get killed. And I don't think the war is an answer. If the people can overthrow the regime, they can do that.
Many of the people interviewed are part of families who came to the U.S. in the late 1970s and early 80s, shortly after Iran became an Islamic Republic. Since the Israeli strikes intensified earlier this month, and especially during the last 24 hours, they have had great difficulty reaching friends and relatives who live in Iran. Adi Bahrami is a researcher at UCLA. He came to the U.S. 3 years ago.
I think most of us, we are happy that these leaders are being, you know, are taking, getting down. But at the same time, we don't want chaos in the country. So it's like we are happy, and at the same time, we are also like a bit worried about what's going to happen afterwards.
For some Iranian Americans, the big concern is the possibility of a long, drawn-out conflict. Jonathan Rad does not want a repeat of U.S. involvement in Iraq.
Like, we don't want Iraq 2.0, and we don't want to bring in American troops. Best case scenario, the Ayatollah is out. You know, that could lead to total peace. It could.
And that's another thing everyone we spoke to agreed with. They would like to see Iran's leader, the Ayatollah, removed from power. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
National parks bring in a lot of tourism dollars, especially in the summer.
Everybody that comes to my motel goes to the park. So the park is everything to us.
But with the National Park Service facing budget cuts, business owners near parks are worried. We visit Joshua Tree National Park Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. International monitors say they haven't seen widespread environmental contamination after the U.S. bombed three nuclear sites in Iran yesterday. The International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran tells them there's been no increase in off-site radiation levels, and neighboring countries are watching the situation closely. FedEx says founder Fred Smith has died. The Marine Corps vet revolutionized package delivery when he created the company in 1973. He was 80 years old. And in professional basketball, the NBA championship will be decided tonight in Oklahoma City as the Thunder and the Indiana Pacers face off. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrew Limbong. All right, we've spent much of this hour unpacking the U.S. entering the war between Israel and Iran. To better understand the big picture stakes, we've called Robin Wright. She's a journalist who's written a number of books on the Middle East, including The Last Great Revolution, Turmoil and Transformation in Iran, and she joins me now. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Andrew.
Did this bombing by the Trump administration surprise you?
I think there's been momentum over the last 3 or 4 days headed in this direction. So it kind of became inevitable. The scope of it, I think, was a surprise that the United States went after three targets. And of course, we don't know the extent of the damage yet, but this is clearly a military setback for Iran's nuclear program.
Let's talk about endgame here from both President Trump and Netanyahu. Is there any daylight between the two of them there?
Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu has repeatedly talked about regime change. His defense minister has said that the supreme leader could no longer exist. I think that Israel implicitly has broader aims than simply military. And President Trump made clear in his address to the nation that this, he hoped, would be a one and done, and that Iran would come back to the negotiating table immediately and basically surrender. Now, remember, Iran does have a right to a civilian peaceful nuclear energy program as a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But the bottom line is that both the United States and Israel want Iran not to have any capability to enrich uranium for any purpose. So there's a gap between the two leaders in Israel and the United States, and it's unclear how each of them might proceed if Iran doesn't cave.
Iran is used to taking the long view. And sometimes I think here in the U.S., we kind of forget the scope of history. I think that's a fair assessment. You know, there's that adage, the enemy also gets a vote. Is that something we should be keeping in mind here?
Well, absolutely. First of all, Iran, or the Islamic Republic since its 1979 revolution, has survived an 8-year war with Iraq. It faced many different challenges politically, economically, militarily, and the supreme leader is still in power, the system still exists. And you have to look at the broader society and culture. The majority of Iranians are Shiite, and the religion is based on the idea of that it's better to die fighting injustice than to live with injustice. And there's a minority mentality in Iran. Ethnically, Iranians are a minority in terms of their Muslim sect, they are a minority. So there are on many fronts that instinct of survival and feeling like you're perpetually the victim and that you need to stand up against those attacking or repressing you.
Hmm. All right, I want to zoom out a bit. Who are the winners from the attack on yesterday outside of Israel? I'm wondering, like, what is China thinking today?
China has watched as the United States was bogged down arming Israel for the war on Gaza, its attacks on Hezbollah in Lebanon. China's also watched as the United States has been engaged in rearming Ukraine. Several presidents in the 21st century have talked about China really is the priority and the greatest threat long-term to the United States. And there has been nothing to hamper China, which has territorial ambitions when it comes to Taiwan, too.
But what about Russia? Iranian drones have been a key weapon used against Ukraine, and Iran's foreign minister is now headed to meet with Putin. What's Russia likely to do next?
It's very interesting, and that's a good question, because Iran has been critical to Russia's campaign against Ukraine. It has provided hundreds, even thousands of drones to Russia, and they have been used brutally against Ukrainian civilian targets, some military as well. And the question is, can Iran provide more drones to Russia? Or has Russia built up a capacity with the help of Iranian technology on its own to continue the kind of drone attacks that have been critical in the war in Ukraine? So Russia has been an ally of Iran, but they are also very different kinds of governments. And even Vladimir Putin doesn't want to see Iran, which is not too far away, have a nuclear capability. And that was the one thing the world's six major powers agreed on in 2015, even though there were tensions back then over Ukraine and Russia's occupation of Crimea.
There's a lot of attention today on whether Iran might retaliate against U.S. service members or soft targets in the region. But Iran has always fought in a sort of like asymmetrical fashion. What do you think we should expect now?
Iran, since its 1979 revolution, has used asymmetric tactics over and over against what it views as its enemies. It used the first suicide bombs against Israel in Lebanon, and then against two U.S. embassies and the Marine peacekeepers in Lebanon in the 1980s. It engaged in hostage takings, including some of my friends in Lebanon, and as well at the U.S. embassy in Tehran. It has gone after Saudi Arabia's oil facilities. So it is not going to engage in reaction that is tit for tat in terms of military sophistication. It has the ability to go after regionally, whether it's some of the 40,000 U.S. forces in the Middle East or U.S. and Israeli targets elsewhere in the world.
Knowing Iran as well as you do, what are you going to be keeping an eye out for the next couple of days?
I wouldn't be surprised if Iran retaliated in some way and then sent a message that it didn't want to see a war escalate. I think Iran wants this over. I think it wants diplomacy. The problem is, even if all parties get to the negotiating table, can they really come up with an arrangement that all sides can accept? So that's really the most important thing. This conflict will not end militarily. It has to have some kind of diplomatic outcome that will ensure there are no further flashpoints about what Iran is doing militarily.
That's journalist Robin Wright, author of The Last Great Revolution, Turmoil and Transformation in Iran. Robin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
there is some other news going on in the world. For instance, this weekend marks 50 years since movies changed forever. My colleague Scott Detrow recently spoke with two NPR film lovers about a certain splashy summer film.
Before you see it, one sound tells you it's coming. But on June 20th, 1975, when it was released, nobody knew that music yet. Nobody could predict the phenomenon that Steven Spielberg's Jaws would become.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
The film would help usher in a new era of Hollywood filmmaking, make composer John Williams a household name, and put Spielberg on the path to becoming the most successful filmmaker of all time. 50 years later, we are revisiting this classic, all the ways it changed the movies and the lessons, both good and bad, that the movies took from it. Joining me now is NPR film critic Bob Mondello and All Things Considered producer Mark Rivers, who spearheads these weekly movie talks. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey, Scott.
So let's talk Jaws. Bob, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah.
Because you, among the three of us, have the unique experience. You saw Jaws in theaters when it came out.
On the first day. I was in the movie business at the time. I was a publicist, and we had it, but we didn't have it in a theater near me, so I went to somebody else's theater, paid to see it. I remember it's the only time I've ever seen a theater fill up from the front. Mm. It was the first row was full almost immediately, and then the second, and then the third. Everybody wanted to, get splashed. I don't know. But it was amazing. It was thrilling to see it with an audience. Please tell me that you've both seen it with a crowd, right?
Mm-hmm. Never.
No, really?
The biggest crowd, just me and my girlfriend.
That's my biggest crowd, Mark.
Deprived. I know.
It's an amazing audience picture. Yeah. It's just great.
I came to Jaws as it being this important movie. You look back at those contemporary reviews calling it exhilarating and you know, thrill ride and so scary. I kind of approached it like
a work of art.
I put Jaws in the same category in my head as something like The Godfather or Maltese Falcon, Citizen Kane. Is like this movie is going to teach you how to make a movie. This is film grammar 101 for modern filmmaking. And I think rewatching it last night, that's kind of how I look at it today. It's just like, if you want to know what camera techniques that can help heighten suspense, if you want to know how to provide details for the characters without making it seem like exposition, this is just like ground zero for all that.
That's not wrong. I mean, although he was inventing it as he went.
Oh,
he was a
really
very inexperienced guy. And the craziness of trying to film on the ocean, which apparently had never been done before. I mean, don't you just assume that Mutiny on the Bounty, they must have been on an ocean? But those were all done in big
tanks, yeah.
Right? And he wanted to shoot on the ocean, had not realized what weather would do. and how
apparently
there
are waves in the ocean. Bob, like, what else do you think, like, absolutely is perfectly done in this movie in a way that was a template for other movies?
Well, the absence of the shark is the big thing. For the first hour, you don't really see the shark. Am I right? You've just seen this recently.
I have not. It's mostly through suggestion, through, like, a broken pier that, like, goes out to sea but turns around and starts chasing the guy.
Or a fin, right?
Maybe you see a fin. And most of it is John Williams' iconic score working. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the music personifies the shark. I think now when I rewatch it, it's not even the shark or the shark sequences that I love. You know, it's really the characters. You know, when Robert Shaw's Clint being introduced, you know, with the nails going down the chalkboard.
Y'all know me. Know how I earn a living.
It's Richard Dreyfuss's character, Hooper, and that wonderful laugh of his, or him just kind of explaining the stakes.
I pulled a tooth the size of a shot glass out of the wreck hull of a boat out there, and it was the tooth of a great white. It was Ben Gardner.
In comparison to all, you know, the countless offspring that Jaws has spawned.
Yeah, which we'll talk about in a moment.
Yeah, but it's really the characters that bring me back all the time. It's the character details.
Let's just talk about the economics of movies and how much this changed thing. This Jaws becomes the first movie to hit $100 million at the box office. How did that compare to what came before it?
It's hard to explain how big a movie is by looking at box office because the price of tickets changes and it's just a frustration. I think attendance is a better way to do it. The number one and number two pictures most years play to between 40 and 60 million people in the U.S. Occasional films are bigger. 2 years before Jaws, The Exorcist played to 109 million people, I think.
Keep away! The Sour's mine.
But it opened at Christmas and took a long time to play to that many people. Mm-hmm. You look at Titanic played to 104 million. Avengers Endgame played to 93 million. Those are really big. But Jaws opened in what was then considered an absolute dead zone in the summer and played to 126 million people. Nothing that's open
couldn't compare
since then has been like this.
And I think also, if I had to theorize a little bit, I think it's this kind of just a situation of a perfect kind of coalescence of factors. You know, you had, I think at this time where there was youth spending power. You know, there were kids and teens that could go to the movies on their own. Mm-hmm. Also, the studio behind Jaws launched this huge marketing campaign, right, when like TV marketing was really popping off, blitzing your TV screens and also on the radio. They had merchandise tie-ins at movie theaters. And I think also, you know, taking stock of the cultural climate, this movie is coming out soon after the fall of Saigon, coming in the wake of Watergate, in the wake of the Kent State killings. And I think there's this kind of just exhaustion. And you think about some of these past movies like Chinatown or The Godfather, The Exorcist, these kind of movies that are kind of cynical about America. And here's Jaws that, while it does sneak in cynicism, is just all about an escape. You want to be on
some
vacation.
Some people are eaten by a shark.
Some people are eaten by a shark. It's all in good fun.
It's the mayor. The mayor is the bad guy, right?
The mayor is the bad guy, yeah.
And yeah, no, you're right. That's a really interesting observation.
The mayor is such a goofy character.
But so poignant. You know, you establish this character who is saying, one or two people are going to die, but our economy is at stake.
Now, if you fellas are concerned about the beaches, you do whatever you have to make them safe. But those beaches will be open for this weekend.
I think there's a reason why Jaws was watched often during COVID. I think a lot of our politicians are making similar calculations as the mayor in Jaws.
See, I like the geopolitics.
He's just trying to get everybody out in a crowd. What are you talking about?
Oh, yeah, innocent, innocent.
Mark, you touched on this before. On one hand, Jaws is widely credited with creating the genre of the summer blockbuster. On the other hand, every single movie that has been inspired by Jaws seems to not take any of these lessons we're talking about. Small, tight, so you know, withholding. It's spectacle. It's Sharknado.
Wait. Yes and no. I mean, I think Alien was influenced by it, and that's, what, seven people on a spaceship, right? It's, it keeps it small.
You still don't understand what you're dealing with, do you? Perfect organism. It's structural perfection is matched to any virus hostility.
So sometimes they do it, but you're right about blockbusters getting massive. Now they have to have 5,000 people running at, you know, each other.
The whole world has to be at stake and not like a beach. And, you know, even for its time, Jaws was not a big budget movie. You know, I think I looked at a Business Insider article and adjusted for inflation, its budget was around $64 million. The latest Mission Impossible is $400 million. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a testament to Spielberg doing a lot with a little.
The lesson that Hollywood took from this is almost entirely an economic lesson.
Yes.
They learned that you could open things in the summer, that all of those people being out of school was a good thing. I mean, when I was a teenager, this was not a big movie-going time.
I remember I read that folks like Pauline Kael go on vacation during the summer.
Right, in the summer, because there's nothing opening.
Yeah.
And now it's the time when I have to be here because, you know, because all these movies are opening. So it changed that. It changed the dynamics of a season. And then it changed the way that they marketed things, because what you were talking about earlier about the blitzing of advertising, there were three major networks and Fox, which was sort of off on the side, and three networks, and they ran two dozen 30-second commercials each day for 3 days before that thing opened.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill.
Everybody in the country had seen it. So, of course, 126 million people went to see it.
That's Bob Mondello and Mark Rivers. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
For Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. Please stay with NPR and NPR.org for the latest on the aftermath of the U.S. strikes on Iranian nuclear sites. Our journalists will bring you the latest reporting and analysis on this story and what it means for you. I'm Andrew Limbaugh. Have a good night.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at Subaru.com/care. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.